begin. Really good to see you all again. What we are going to be doing this evening is finishing off what we started last week. That is our journey through the history of Israel. And we're going to finish some 400 years before Christ. As far as the Old Testament is concerned, it's the prophet Malachi, the last book in our Old Testament, who begins the period of 400 years of silence. That is 400 years of prophetic silence. Obviously, things continued. History did its stuff. Lots went on, as we see from the Apocrypha, and we'll have a quick look at that at the end. But in terms of our timeline, we finished a couple of weeks ago with the death of David in about 971 BC. I don't know whether you like history dates. I gave up history, or modern history, I think as they call it, before O-level. I didn't even do history O-level. But somehow, being of a certain age, the history dates that you get taught in school stay with you and last as a sort of framework. And I think that's true also of the history of Israel. So David died in about 971 BC, quite a long time ago. And this evening what we're going to be doing is looking at the life and reign of Solomon. So he lasted about 50 years on the throne. And then when Solomon died, there was the great tragedy, if you like, the great split in the nation into Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And I think we can say that generally things went downhill from there. And as we saw last week, theologically speaking, the fortunes of the two kingdoms, Israel and Judah, are seen through the eyes of the character of her kings. And in the case of Israel, all of them turn out to be bad until Israel gets defeated by Assyria in BC 722, so that's about 200 years. And over that period, Israel and Judah, not infrequently, are fighting each other. The history of Judah, who staggers on for another 130 years or so, until she gets taken into exile, this time in Babylon, is a bit happier, because she has some good kings, particularly Hezekiah and Josiah, but one or two others as well. And then begins the exile of some 70 years. And just as the Exodus was a defining event in the history of Israel, so the Exodus, in the case, strictly speaking, I say reflection in Israel's life, actually it was Judah at that stage, but taking Israel as the overall description of the kingdom, it gave them a lot to think about. And it provided very fertile material for the prophets in particular to say, well, this is what happens when you disobey God. And what happens at the end of that period is Cyrus is now in power. He reverses the previous policy of taking nations out of their land and bringing them into exile. Instead, he sends them back, and he allows them to worship their own gods. So in the case of Israel, Judah, Yahweh. And in terms of biblical history, we see the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem under Nehemiah, the restoration of religious life under Ezra, and the building of the Second Temple. So this period of time, from the end of the 6th century through to 70 AD, when the temple gets destroyed by the Romans, is called the Second Temple period. So the books that we'll be covering this evening, 1 and 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, Esther, Ezra and Nehemiah. And I make no apology for the fact that we're going to be doing it, I'm afraid, at breakneck speed. But the hope is that, apart from sending you home breathless, I send you home a little better informed in terms, I think, of being able to see the overall framework. We'll be looking at the prophets after Easter. After Easter, next time we start with the wisdom literature, finish that off after Easter, and then we have two sessions on the writing prophets, the major prophets and the minor prophets. But we shouldn't forget, of course, there were lots of non-writing prophets, Elijah and Elisha, supreme among them, and we'll be looking at those two this evening. Also, by way of reminder, the key themes that we looked at, I won't be repeating what I said last time, kingship, the word of the Lord, particularly in the mouth of the prophets, the temple, worship, and the particular interests of the chronicler, the author of 1 and 2 Chronicles. I'll be touching on that this evening. So let's kick off with Solomon. Those of you who heard me preach at the 10 o'clock service yesterday on David will have heard me say that David didn't plan properly for the succession. And although the chosen heir, as far as David is concerned, is Solomon, the heir apparent is his elder brother Adonijah. And Adonijah has support of the commander of the army, Joab, and one of the two chief priests, Abiathar. Happily, Adonijah gets outmaneuvered, thanks to some quick thinking by Bathsheba, David's wife, the prophet Nathan, and actually some even quicker thinking by the old king. So Solomon becomes king, and he secures his position by putting to death Adonijah and Joab, and by banishing Abiathar. There's then a very striking event at Gibeon, which is a town 6 miles from Jerusalem, where the tabernacle and the altar are situated at this time. And God appears to Solomon in a dream. And God asks Solomon what he, Solomon, wants. And Solomon says to God, please give me wisdom. Please give me the gift of wisdom, because here am I, just come to the throne. How on earth am I going to govern this great people of yours? And God is absolutely delighted that Solomon has asked for wisdom and not honour and glory and riches, the death of his enemies, and so on. And God says to Solomon, yes, I will give you wisdom, and because you haven't asked for these other things, I'll give you these as well. So in terms of empire and prosperity, Israel reaches its peak during the reign of Solomon. And Solomon's wisdom in making judgments becomes legendary. There's a lovely little vignette just after this of a couple of women who come to Solomon with rather a strange story, which is that there's a live child and there's a dead child, and there's an argument about the woman to whom the live child belongs. And because the story is that one woman whose child was dead, then while the other woman was asleep, took her live child and clasped it to her instead. And so Solomon says, well, the only way to sort this out is to cut the live child in half. Bring me a sword and give one half to each woman. And then, of course, the real mother says, oh, no, don't do that. You know, what I want is my child to live. And the other woman says, yes, quite right, cut it in two. It seems a slightly strange thing to say. So, of course, Solomon says, give it to the first one. And Solomon's reputation spreads. His court was enormous. It's quite difficult to get your head around this next statistic. 700 wives of royal birth, 300 concubines. Now, the problem with that, apart, I suppose, from the obvious one, is that, as the author of Kings put it, his wives led him astray. How did they lead him astray? Well, of course, they came from other kingdoms with foreign gods, with a small g. And so idolatrous worship of foreign gods became the real problem, and in effect caused the downfall of the kingdom in 922. Solomon makes a trade pact with Hiram, king of Lebanon, to supply materials for the building of the temple. Remember, we said last time that David, although David wanted to build a temple for the Lord, he was told by the prophet Nathan, no, it was not David who would build it, because David was a man of war. Rather, it was going to be left to his son Solomon, a man of peace, to build the temple. And that's precisely what Solomon does. And we're given very detailed a description of the temple, its measurements, and so on. And Solomon has lots of other building projects as well. And chapter 8 of 1 Kings sees the ark brought to the temple and Solomon's wonderful prayer of dedication, which is mirrored in 2 Chronicles 6. And you get this verse in 2 Chronicles 7, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. The priests could not enter the temple of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled it. And if I were to ask you what that reminded you of, well, the answer's there on the screen. But in the same way that the glory of the Lord had filled the tabernacle, which is what we read at the end of Exodus 40, again, that happens. And then extrapolating, that now under the new covenant, all those who believe in Jesus are temples of the Holy Spirit, and that as there is a filling in us as believers of the Holy Spirit, so we trust and pray that to some extent at least the glory of the Lord shines out for others to see, just as when Moses came down from the mountain having encountered Yahweh, so his face shone with the glory of the Lord. God appears to Solomon again and says, I will establish your throne forever, just as I promised to your father David. But there is then a solemn warning that if Solomon or his descendants turn away from God and don't keep God's commands and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then God will cut off Israel from the land he has given them and will reject the temple that he's consecrated for his name. The temple will be destroyed, and everybody will know that the reason for that is that Israel has forsaken her God and worshipped other gods. And of course, that is what happened. The Queen of Sheba visits Solomon and is completely overwhelmed, not just by his wealth and the happiness of his people, but by his wisdom. There's that lovely verse in chapter 11 where the Queen of Sheba tests Solomon with hard questions, rather like a sort of modern, a slightly upmarket pub quiz. And Solomon is able to provide all the answers to her difficult questions. But as we said, the idyll was not to last. And as I say on the slide, the secret of the unity of Israel and Judah was always going to lie in the worship of the one God. And merely having a single king would not do the trick. There's a very interesting warning given by Samuel when he anoints Saul to be the first king of Israel. Samuel says this: if you fear the Lord and serve and obey him and do not rebel against his commands, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord your God, good. But if you do not obey the Lord, and if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you, as it was against your ancestors. And that, of course, is what happens. and internal strife threatens both Israel in the north, Judah in the south, and each of them are then destroyed by their larger neighbours, Assyria and Babylon, respectively. So Solomon dies, and he's succeeded by his son, Rehoboam. But Rehoboam doesn't have Solomon's wisdom, and he follows the advice of the younger rather than the older men at his court. And as a result, the northern tribes rebel, they declare UDI, and set up the rival kingdom of Israel under Jeroboam. And over the next 200 years, the division remains permanent. There's a constant state of either hot war or cold war between the two kingdoms. And only in, there are a couple of periods of time when the breach between them was temporarily healed through a marriage alliance. And part of the problem was, of course, that Israel didn't have access to the temple at Jerusalem. So Jeroboam in the north needs a new religious centre to counter the hold of Jerusalem, and he creates two new sanctuaries at Bethel and Dan. He sets up golden calves, reminiscent perhaps of what happened when Moses was up the mountain and Aaron was prevailed upon to make the golden calf for the Israelites in the wilderness to worship. And he builds shrines on high places and ominously appoints priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. So it's not surprising that as time goes by, the worship of God by the people of Israel becomes ever more degenerate. Prophecy, although it's focused in particular chapters, thinking particularly of Elijah and Elisha, becomes something of a leitmotif. There was a prophet called Ahijah who had prophesied to Jeroboam while Solomon was alive that Jeroboam would become king of the northern tribes. Ahijah then pops up again and prophesies Jeroboam's downfall. You get common formulas. The way that kings works in what kings doesn't do is give you a history of Israel and then a history of Judah. What it does is interweave the histories of the two kingdoms according to the lives of the king. So it deals first with the reign of one king, waits till he dies, and then turns to the other kingdom and tells you what's going on there. So for example, the other events of Jeroboam's reign, his wars and how he ruled, are written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel. He reigned for 22 years and then rested with his ancestors, and Nadab, his son, succeeded him as king. What's happening in Judah? Rehoboam, son of Solomon, was king in Judah. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite, and so on. So in these chapters 15 and 16 of 1 Kings, we find a catalogue of successive kings of Judah and Israel. And as we've said already, a good king is one who promotes the worship of God. A bad king is one who follows idolatrous ways. The religious life of Israel reaches an all-time low with the 22-year reign of King Ahab, who, along with his thoroughly corrupt wife, Jezebel of Tyre, and of course, Jezebel has given her name to a particular type of person, brings into the land the worship of the Phoenician god Melkart. Melkart is the Baal, B-A-A-L, of these chapters. And so into this desperate situation, God sends the one who's described in Matthew's gospel as the greatest of all the prophets, that is Elijah. Baal was worshipped particularly as a weather god. And so God, under Elijah, sets up a demonstration that he, Yahweh, alone has power over sun and rain. And you get this gloriously dramatic contest in chapter 18 in Baal's own territory. So it's like, the top team playing away. It's what should have happened in Ireland on Saturday. There should have been a glorious victory at rugby union for England, but it didn't quite happen like that. But anyway, so we're in enemy territory. Apologies to Irish supporters. And there's been 3 years of drought. And so Elijah sets up a contest between himself and the prophets of Baal, who is able to send rain. And without going into the detail, the contest is won by Elijah, or at least by Yahweh. All the prophets of Baal are slaughtered. But the contest leaves Elijah completely drained, spiritually, physically, in the grip of depression, fear, and disappointment. And Jezebel is breathing blue murder down his throat. And Elijah goes south, finds himself at Mount Horeb. Places have particular resonances in the Bible. Mount Horeb was the place where God made himself known to Moses. And here he speaks to Elijah. You may remember there was the earthquake, the fire, and so on. And then the still small voice. And God speaks to Elijah through the still small voice. Elijah saying, I only am left. And God says, come on, pull yourself together. I've got 7,000 who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. And Elijah is commissioned to anoint Hazael as king over Aram, Jehu as king over Israel, and Elisha to succeed him as prophet. Beginning of 2 Kings, Elijah is taken up to heaven, and Elisha asks for a double portion of Elijah's spirit. And that's what happens. And you get a series of rather lovely stories of Elisha. Elisha is a man of great compassion. And he's not just a miracle worker. The miracles that he does, providing oil for a destitute widow of one of the prophets. He brings back to life the son of a rich woman at Shunem. And then, of course, he heals Naaman of leprosy. There's tremendous compassion motivating Elisha. And in the context of war between the kingdom of Aram and Israel, Elisha is given divine knowledge of Aram's plans and tells the king of Israel, sorry, forgive me, continuing the rugby metaphor. It's as if, isn't it, in the line-out. You see the instructions to the team that's throwing, but it's as if the other team know what the instruction is. And Aram, not surprisingly, gets a bit fed up of this, and the king of Aram wants to capture Elisha. And there's a lovely scene in 2 Kings 6 where Elisha and his servant are captured by Aram, and the servant is absolutely terrified, and Elisha prays that his eyes would be opened, and the servant looks up and he sees the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around them. And then the Aramites' eyes are blinded. They're led into Samaria, the capital of Israel, and when their eyes are opened, Elisha advises the king of Israel to feed the Aramites, to look kindly on them, so that when they go back to their king, they'll say, actually, the Israelites are not so bad after all. Let's not fight them anymore. And we then get a catalogue in the next 10 chapters or so of the kings of Israel down to the time of exile. And I don't think I've got time to go through them all. But to say that the last of the kings of Israel is Hoshea, who reigns really as a puppet of Assyria. There's a constant to-ing and fro-ing during this time of trying to make allegiances with other powers, the particular other power being Egypt. But Assyria doesn't look very kindly on Israel, trying to make an alliance with Egypt. And so Assyria besieges Samaria, Samaria falls, and the whole of the population gets carted off to Nineveh, which is the capital of Assyria. And you get a really penetrating analysis in 2 Kings 17. Why has this happened? The people of Israel want to know. And the fact is, you've rejected your rightful God, Yahweh. You've gone other gods. You've pursued heathen practices. You've disobeyed the law. You've ignored the prophets. And so the Israelites are taken off to Assyria, and then, as was its practice, Assyria brings a series of foreign people into the land. And of course, those foreign people bring their foreign gods. And a strange hodgepodge of religion emerges. And of course, by the time of Jesus's day, which is 700 years later, you've got the Samaritans and their particular form of religion, and of course Jesus's encounter with them. Meanwhile, what happens in Judah? Well, Judah survives for just over about 130 years. Among their kings, Hezekiah rules for 29 years, from 729 to 687. What's his epitaph? He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, cut down the Asherah poles used to worship Baal. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made. For up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it. Do you remember that episode in Numbers where in the wilderness the people of Israel are afflicted by a plague of serpents? And what God says to Moses is, look, make a bronze serpent, lift it up on a pole. And everybody who looks away from the writhing around on the ground, looks up in faith to the pole, will be healed. And Jesus uses that in John chapter 3 as a picture of the salvation that he wins on the cross. Just as Moses lifted up the bronze pole in the wilderness, I, the Son of Man, will be lifted up. So the problem of the Israelites was the plague of serpents. Our problem is sin. The bronze snake is lifted up. Jesus is lifted up on the cross. And just as the bronze, the thing that's made of bronze is a serpent, so we read in 2 Corinthians 5 that Jesus is made to be sin. So the problem for the Israelites was serpents. The bronze serpent is made. Our problem is sin. Jesus is made to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God, the great exchange. So Hezekiah's been on the throne for not long, actually. I think a year or two. And Sennacherib, who is the king of Assyria, attacks Jerusalem and lays siege to it. And there's some wonderful accounts of what happens. That the leader of Sennacherib's forces addresses the people of Judah in their language. And he's told by Hezekiah's court, please don't speak in their language. We'd rather they didn't understand. And of course the Assyrian says, well, actually we do want them to understand, because we want them to know what's going to happen when we capture the city. But God does answer the prayers of Hezekiah, and as prophesied by Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, 185,000 Assyrian soldiers are destroyed by the angel of the Lord. Hezekiah becomes ill, and God answers his prayer to get better. Hezekiah does fall from grace a bit at the end of his life, because envoys of the king of Babylon, which is then becoming the rising power in the east, come to visit him, and Hezekiah shows the envoys all the wealth of his palace. And Isaiah, the prophet, comes and says to Hezekiah, you shouldn't have done that, because actually the Babylonians now know what you've got, what there is there to capture. And after you are dead, the kingdom, your kingdom of Judah, will be overthrown. And some words of Hezekiah are reported that I think, well, it's rather sad that he thought that. We're told that Hezekiah says, well, actually, you know, it's all right, I'll be dead, which is not a very noble sentiment. And I mean, Hezekiah didn't do badly, but Josiah later on does a lot better. Hezekiah is succeeded by Manasseh. Manasseh, politically, was a really successful king. He reigns for 55 years in the 7th century. But he's hugely wicked in terms of his idolatry and the way he leads the people astray. What's interesting is that the parallel account in 2 Chronicles reports that Manasseh has a change of heart and repents before he dies. And then at the end of the 7th century, you get Josiah, the best of Judah's kings. The high priest Hilkiah discovers the book of the law, probably a copy of Deuteronomy, while the temple is being repaired. The book of the law is read aloud to Josiah. He appreciates how far the people of God have fallen from their worship, and he renews the covenant. There's a complete purge of all the idolatrous public places. The feast of the Passover is celebrated again. But God's judgment is certain. It's delayed, it's not reversed. And Josiah then dies in rather a futile battle with the Egyptian pharaoh, Necho. Necho puts Josiah's son on the throne. And there is then a bit of to-ing and fro-ing between Egypt and Babylon. But ultimately, Babylon besieges and takes Jerusalem. Babylon puts on the throne King Zedekiah, who himself rebels and tries to flee to Egypt, but he's captured. Zedekiah's two sons are killed before his eyes, and he's blinded and then taken to Babylon. However, there is a glimmer of hope, because the king of Judah that was deposed before Zedekiah was put on the throne, Jehoiachin, after 35 years, he's released from prison in Babylon. He's treated kindly. And interestingly, there's a paragraph in 2 Kings 25, which is repeated at the end of Jeremiah. So you have a sense, as you get to the end of this history, while the exile is going on, that all is not lost. There is a glimmer of hope. So far as the history of the exile is concerned, there are isolated references in the Old Testament, particularly in Ezekiel. And you'll remember Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. And during this time, Judah is left and remains virtually empty. Jeremiah, the prophet, encourages the exiles to marry, to settle down, to seek the good of the city. And one of the great things about all the prophets is they tend to do, some fairly bizarre things. This wasn't completely desire. I suppose it was an act of faith that what Jeremiah does is buy some land in Judah, and he deposits the title deeds of the land with a relative. In other words, he's saying, actually, there will come a time when land is bought and sold again in Judah, and I'm giving you evidence of my good faith in this. And so what happens? Babylon falls to King Cyrus of Persia, and at the end of the 6th century, Babylon, Cyrus, as we said, reverses the previous policy. These captured peoples are sent back, and a total of about 43,000 people return from Babylon to Israel. So what happens then? The return we read about particularly in Ezra and Nehemiah, and together with the little book of Esther, which is a glorious book. They cover the last century or so of Old Testament Jewish history. So roughly we're talking about the period from 538 BC to 433 BC. And Ezra follows on from Chronicles. There's some verses at the end of 2 Chronicles and the beginning of Ezra, which are exactly the same. And Ezra and Nehemiah together describe the three-stage return. First of all, the main party come back with Zerubbabel in BC 538-537. Second, some 80 years later, there's a party that goes with Ezra, the priest and lawgiver, BC 458. And then 3 years after that, Nehemiah's party. And the story of Esther belongs to the time between the time when the temple was rebuilt and Ezra returns. So what happens in Ezra? Well, picking out some of the aspects, there's a very interesting note at the beginning of Ezra which says this: all their neighbours, that is the Jews' neighbours, assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts, in addition to all the freewill offerings. Now, I don't know what that reminds you of, thinking of the Exodus, but do you remember what happened when the Israelites left the land of Egypt? The people of Egypt, well, they were delighted to see them go with the death of all the firstborn in the land. But they gave them jewellery and all sorts of precious things to take with them. That was a sign, if you like, of the favour of God. The temple is rebuilt. First, the altar. Why the altar? Well, with the rebuilding of the altar, worship and sacrifice can begin again on the pattern laid down by Moses. But what's interesting, and this is a pattern again you get in Nehemiah with the rebuilding of the walls, not everybody is delighted to see what's going on. And their adversaries are mainly the Samaritans, the mixed race that had resulted from the people settled in the land by the kings of Assyria. And they succeed in bringing to a standstill the work on rebuilding the temple for 15 years. But then another king comes to the throne, Darius. The Samaritans again try to get the work stopped, but it has the opposite effect, because Darius asks for a search to be made in the archives, and the original decree of Cyrus is found, and so the work continues apace. Ezra, meanwhile, has gone back to Babylon. He comes back again. Interestingly, again, that's a pattern that's common to Nehemiah and to Ezra. And Ezra is officially authorized by Artaxerxes, the king, to teach the law, to appoint magistrates, to offer sacrifices, to decorate the temple. And Another issue that occurs both in Ezra and in Nehemiah is the issue of mixed marriages. And God has forbidden this in Deuteronomy 7, not so much because of racial prejudice, because as we see par excellence in the example of Solomon, it leads to idolatry. And what Ezra finds when he comes back is that a lot of the Jewish people have married foreign wives. And this is a huge deal. And he asks the people to confess their sins, those who have married foreign wives to separate themselves from them. And there's a sort of naming and shaming, because the individuals who are guilty of intermarriage are listed at the end of the book. And we read, interestingly, in Malachi chapter 2, some of these individuals had even divorced Jewish wives in order to marry these pagan women. So that's Ezra. Nehemiah starts in 446 BC. Nehemiah's brother Hanani brings very sad news of how the colony in Jerusalem is faring. Nehemiah, interestingly, is often read and taught as a manual for Christian leadership, how Christian leaders should conduct themselves. Nehemiah, meanwhile, is the cupbearer of the king, which is a very privileged position. The thing about the cupbearer, of course, is he has to taste the wine before the king drinks it, in case it's been poisoned. And Nehemiah spends 4 months grieving, weeping over the situation at Jerusalem. And the king notices one day that Nehemiah is looking rather sad, and he says, "Why are you sad?" And of course, this is the passage that follows is great authority for the arrow prayer. What we need to remember about arrow prayers is that they come out of a pre-existing relationship of the individual with God. So there have been 4 months of praying, and then Nehemiah shoots up an arrow prayer to God as to how he should answer Artaxerxes. And so he says, "Why should not my face be sad when the walls of my native city Jerusalem are in disrepair?" And so Artaxerxes says, "Yep, fine, you can go. Just give me a time when you'll be back again." And so Nehemiah gets permission, gets materials from Artaxerxes, letters securing his safe passage and so on. And then there's that very interesting account of what he does when he gets back to Jerusalem. He doesn't tell anybody what he's going to do until he's made a personal inspection. He rides around the city by night looking at the walls. And he then allocates the people to rebuild the walls, particular people for a particular section of the city. And as we said, with the rebuilding of the temple, there is opposition, and all sorts of tricks are played on Nehemiah to try and deflect him, but he won't be deflecting. There are internal problems. Rich Jews have been lending money and exacting interest from their fellow countrymen, contrary to the law in Exodus, and Nehemiah takes firm action to set things right, as also, as we've said, with those who've made marriages with foreign women. It seems a bit tough, or it may seem tough, that both Ezra and Nehemiah are saying to people who have married foreign women, look, divorce them, in effect. Yahweh had said, I hate divorce. And I suppose what we need to do is to read this command in the light of the importance, of the absolute primary importance of the worship of God as a holy God. He is a jealous God, and he wants his people primarily to worship him. Do you remember the first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me. And that's what was being emphasized big time in what both Ezra and Nehemiah was doing. Now, what about this lovely little book of Esther? It's very dangerous, isn't it, to say it's the only book, but I think I mentioned this before. I think it's the only book in the Bible where the name of God isn't mentioned. Answers on a postcard if there's another one. But actually, God, the book is full of God and the providence of God. Because what it's all about is a plot to murder all the Jews. And of course, that has horrible resonances with things, if not in our own lifetime, at least not much more than that. And how the plot is foiled. So we're talking about BC 483. King Ahasuerus, who is Xerxes, gives a great feast. And he's got a very lovely wife called Vashti, Queen Vashti, who has some very fine clothes and jewels. And he commands Queen Vashti to appear and show herself off. And she refuses. And he's absolutely sort of horrified by this and asks all his advisors what he should do. And they say, well, this is really quite a serious thing, because if you don't do anything, then all the wives of all your people will get the idea that it's okay when your husband commands you to appear at a dinner party or whatever to say, no, I won't. So poor old Vashti gets the push, and King Ahasuerus needs another queen. So there's a sort of, it is a sort of beauty contest. And Esther, who is a young Jewish girl, is chosen to be the queen. And her cousin Mordecai discovers a plot to kill the king, and he gets word to Esther, the plotters are killed, but no acknowledgement is given to Mordecai. Then the wicked Haman becomes second, everybody hisses, the wicked Haman becomes second in command. And he gets really cross, because there's Mordecai at the sort of the gate of the palace, and everybody sort of bows down to Haman, and Mordecai refuses to acknowledge him. And when Haman discovers that Mordecai is a Jew, he plots to destroy all the Jews throughout the empire. And he gets the king to sign a letter with his seal, and letters signed with the seal cannot be revoked. And horsemen are sent throughout the empire to say, on a given day, which happily is in 11 months' time, all the Jews will be destroyed. And there's a sort of curious verse, isn't there, which says, the king sat down to feast, and all of Susa, the capital, were perplexed. So anyway, Mordecai hears the news and sends word to Esther that you've got to do something. And there's the famous verse, Esther 4:14, who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And it's a verse that's often used sort of rather like the Gideon's fleece, isn't it? Gideon's fleece, I think, sometimes is misused, but nonetheless, there are occasions when fleeces are proper and right and appropriate. But equally, the idea of somebody being in a particular position for such a time as this may be absolutely right, and you have the opportunity to do something. It may be, I don't know, it may be helping one individual. Let me give a bit of testimony. I came to faith in January 1979. I was then working as a young solicitor in the City of London. And somebody who was a friend, who then became one of my greatest friends, Jonathan Ruffer, was working at a merchant bank, Schroeder's, in the city. And it was a period of 16 months, which Jonathan absolutely hated. I'm not saying anything indiscreet, because it's sort of public record. He sort of hated it. But what he did with me at St. Helens Bishopsgate, that's the other St. Helens Bishopsgate, in the city of London, every Wednesday lunchtime, we would go there with our sandwiches, sit in the choir pews, and read the book of Philippians together. So what Jonathan was doing was discipling me as a young Christian. And Jonathan Fletcher, who's just retired as a vicar in Wimbledon, very old friend who preached at Annie's and my wedding, said to me a year or two later, who knows, you know, when you get to heaven, you may discover that the only reason Jonathan Ruffer had this awful job in the city was that so he was close to you and he could disciple you and read Philippians with you in your lunch hour. And I really believe that. I think there's an awful lot in it. So it's an encouragement. I think this verse and the idea is an encouragement to all of us to look out for the providence of God. And just to, you know, to lift our eyes up away from ourselves, away from the serpents and the sin, so to speak, and the worldly stuff, and just to look up and see what God might be doing. Okay, so back to Esther. Now, relationship between Esther and the king were not exactly like a modern marriage. Well, assuming that modern marriages are like this, you know, that Annie can come into my presence whenever she wants. And does. But in those days, you could only come into the king's presence, and including the wife, if he asked for you. And if you came into the king's presence and he hadn't asked for you, then it was slightly nerve-wracking. And the question was whether or not he would hold out his scepter. And Esther appeared, and happily... And if he didn't hold out his scepter, then you'd be put to death, even if you were his wife. Happily, he held out his scepter. Esther is invited. And what's your request? And Esther says, well, will you come with Haman to a dinner I prepared? So that happens. And then when they're at dinner, the king says to Esther, you know, what's all this about? And Esther says, well, will you and Haman please come back tomorrow night for another dinner? So... sort of playing hard to get in terms of working out what Esther's about. And Haman thinks this is wonderful. He says, you know, gosh, Queen Esther, and of course he doesn't know that Queen Esther is a Jew. I've really got not only the king, but Queen Esther's favour. And he sees Mordecai again, and he's really furious, and he builds a huge gallows on which he's going to hang Mordecai. That night, the king can't sleep. And so he sends for the sort of annals of the kingdom. And he finds out that his life was effectively saved by Mordecai discovering the plot against him. And so he says to his courtiers, well, look, what's been done to reward Mordecai? And they say nothing. So the king sends for Haman. And says to Haman, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honour? And Haman thinks to himself, well, there's no one that the king wants to honour more than me. So he says, well, he, you know, gets his best horse and arrays it and puts the man on the horse and has a herald leading the horse through the town saying, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. And the king says, brilliant reply, get Mordecai the Jew, and put him on the horse, and you lead him through the town. And of course, Haman is absolutely distraught, and goes home and tells his wife and family. And they say, you know, sorry chum, this is the beginning of the end. Then second night comes, king and Haman go to dinner, and Esther basically says, look, there's been a plot to kill all the Jews in your kingdom, in your empire. And the king says, who has done this? The wicked Haman. It's very, very dramatic the queen says. And the king is furious and goes out into the garden. And meanwhile, Haman, terrified, flings himself at Esther's feet, pleads for his life. The king comes back in. He thinks that Haman is trying to assault the queen in his presence. And effectively, Haman is then taken away and hanged on the gallows. Meanwhile, of course, what's going to be done? And Mordecai is promoted in place of Haman. And although the first edict of the king can't be revoked, a second edict is made, sealed, and people ride through the empire. The Jews are allowed to defend themselves. So that's what happens. And all this occurs on the appointed day. Haman's 10 sons are killed. And this is the 14th and 15th day of the month Adar. And the 13th is celebrated as the Feast of Purim. And that continues to this day. And the book closes with a final note attesting the good news that Mordecai made of his power. And it was Gail, actually, who pointed out that Mordecai is not the only Jew who is promoted to high office by a pagan king during a time of exile. Think of Joseph, think of Daniel, for example. Between the Testaments, very rapidly, this is really a history of the rise and fall of particular powers. First, Alexander the Great of Macedon. When he dies, his kingdom is divided between his four generals. The Holy Land becomes a bit of a sort of ping-pong ball between Egypt and Syria. And then in the mid-second century, Antiochus Epiphanes comes to the fore, and he really has it in for the Jews. He violates the temple in Jerusalem. This leads to the revolt of the Maccabees. And under the Maccabees, in the middle of the second century, the Jews achieve, for the first time since Josiah, political freedom. But their independence is fairly short-lived. They fall under Roman rule, under Pompey in BC 63. And although local kings were allowed to remain, Israel, as we know it now, never again achieved independence herself. The Roman Republic gives way to the Roman Empire under Caesar Augustus in BC 27. It was under his successor Tiberius that Jesus was crucified, and under Vespasian that the temple was destroyed in AD 70. So how do we conclude this? Rather, as with part one of the histories, it's a pretty depressing story, interspersed with a few high points, for example, Solomon, Hezekiah, and Josiah. But I think the main point is that the exile, first of Israel to Assyria, and then of Judah to Babylon, they're seen as inevitable by the authors because of their idolatry, because of their turning away from God and his messengers, the prophets. And yes, there is new hope with the return from exile, Ezra's teaching of the law, Nehemiah's rebuilding of the walls and the temple. But in terms of the Messiah, the promised one, spoken of by the prophets, particularly Isaiah, and we'll be returning to this in sessions 15 and 16 after Easter, the Messiah hasn't yet appeared. And so the waiting continues.